Depending on who you are, thunderstorms are either the coolest things ever, or else they are totally terrifying. Lots of kids and grown-ups too are really frightened of the crazy storms that sweep this part of the country every spring and summer. And if you're afraid of thunder, there's not much you can do. Or is there? KCUR's Coy Duggar reports.
Our story begins on a night filled with rolling thunder and the sudden crack of lightning. Now, this is not some horror story of a mad scientist, but it is about someone who kind of thinks like one. This is the tale of a kid inventor.
Yeah, I'm afraid of storms. I don't like hearing it or like seeing the lightning.
That's Julia Leche, an 11-year-old from Leawood, Kansas. After her neighbor's house was struck by lightning, Julia developed a fear for thunderstorms. Flashing lights, loud booms, and a downpour of rain, it's a pretty reasonable thing to be scared about. But when Julia's elementary school held an invention fair, Julia decided to make something to face her fears. She named her invention the Storm Sleeper.
The Storm Sleeper is a pillow fort for your head with a speaker and a reading light so you don't hear the sights or sounds. Storm.
Three pillows are arranged in the shape of a horseshoe with a cloth draped over. You put your head inside and speakers help drown out the thunder by playing music.
Well, like for school last year, my mom just bought like cheap pillows because she thought that was just like another school project. And I used hot glue when I didn't sew, and it took me about like an hour to make.
Julia didn't win her school invention fair, but she knew her design had potential, and she wasn't ready to give up on it.
Last spring, I saw on the Ellen Show this contest called the Frito-Lay Dreamvention Contest, and so I entered just because, like, I already had an invention that I had just made.
A few months later, Julia's family received a phone call.
At first, my parents thought it was a scam, because, like, you never know. But then once they figured out that it wasn't, they were really excited.
Frito-Lay had invited Julia and her family down to Austin, Texas for a special ceremony.
It was really cool because I walked in these doors and there's these big cameras filming me. And they told me that I was a finalist. And I couldn't believe it because, like, I didn't win at my school invention fair. But now I was in the top 5 out of 13,000.
About 1 month later, Julia received news that she was selected as the grand prize winner and would be awarded $250,000. Her mom, Susan, couldn't be more proud of her daughter's journey.
The lessons that she has learned have been invaluable. And to know that, you know, this huge thing that happened to her that is so just surreal, it's amazing to see your child achieve their dreams.
Julia is now in the process of patenting her design. She's run into one small problem about her age, though.
My parents helped get the patent because I'm too young for a patent, so their names are on it.
As part of the Dreamvention contest, a manufacturer created a prototype of Julia's design, and it looks as streamlined as a pillow fort can be. Julia shows me how it works.
So this is like the flap, and it's adjustable. So that, like, you can take it off if you don't want it. And there's a reading light, and then the speaker's built into it.
Her invention gathered a lot of attention. The Kansas legislature even gave her a certificate of recognition for her accomplishment. But Julia's siblings, well, they can be tough critics.
I think they were, like, kind of jealous because, like, they would always say, like, oh, just tape this to this, then, oh, I could enter it and I could win.
Julia's sister, who was in the same room at the time of the interview, was unavailable for comment due to a fit of the giggles. Despite all the fancy awards, what matters most to Julia about her invention is pretty simple.
Just knowing that they could help other people, my invention's good.
And that's the next big step for Julia, getting her design to market so the Storm Sleeper can help other people who are afraid of storms.
That was Coy Duggar talking to 11-year-old Julia Leche about her invention, the Storm Sleeper. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now when you think about who else might benefit from an invention like this, it is not just kids. fear of thunderstorms can be a real problem for adults. So much, in fact, that it has a clinical name, astrophobia. And sufferers don't just reschedule picnics when they hear thunder. They might dive under the bed and stay there for hours. So now, on KCUR's Central Standard, what is astrophobia? And what is springtime in this part of the country like for people who have it? Let's start with Margot C. Watt, a psychology professor in Nova Scotia, who wrote a paper on astrophobia in 2012. Before that, only one study had ever been done. Hi, Margot.
Hi. Nice to join you today.
Nice to talk to you, too. Define astrophobia for us.
Well, in actual fact, astrophobia refers to the fear of thunder and lightning specifically. So the paper that I did was on severe weather phobia, which was a little broader, but the actual term astrophobia, astrape, the Greek word astrape, refers to lightning. So it's a bit more specific, but in all fairness, the literature in this area is full of a lot of different Latin and Greek terms. So it gets confusing.
Why do you think that overall that a phobia relating to severe weather hasn't gotten more attention? It seems like that would affect people really profoundly.
Well, yes. And there are a few of us that have asked that question, especially given that weather is such, you know, plays such a prominent role. And I think we all know people who have very extreme reactions to weather, hide under the bed and do such things. But it has received very little attention, but specific phobias don't tend to get the kind of attention that perhaps other types of anxiety get. So it may fall into that. The other thing is that people don't tend to seek treatment. Very few people with specific phobias, and particularly natural environment phobias, they don't tend to seek treatment, so it doesn't garner a lot of research attention.
Why don't people seek treatment? Do you think that it just feels like this is just part of how I move through the world and not something that they consider as a diagnosis that could get treatment?
Yeah, no, people are often surprised that other people feel the same way. And overall, we know with all the anxiety disorders that, you know, people don't tend to seek treatment at the rates that, you know, we would like to see in terms of it being helpful for them. And oftentimes people just think it's just them. So they can be surprised when they hear that other people experience the same sorts of feelings and fears and symptoms that they do in the anticipation of storms and during storms.
What got you interested in taking things further?
Well, I'm a clinical researcher and practitioner, and I've long been interested in, I find anxiety very interesting. And I also find it, you know, it has its comic elements because, you know, we all know what anxiety feels like. It's something we can all relate to. And we tend to know that our fears are, you know, irrational or disproportionate to the stimulus. So we can all relate to them. And I'm always intrigued by how people, the learning experiences related to the development of anxiety. So with the growing, you know, discussion and concerns expressed about climate change and what the impact of climate change was on severe weather events, et cetera.
Maybe cities being buried underwater, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
If you're inclined to worry.
Exactly. And you begin to wonder, are our fears increasing? So with the increasing media attention, would we see an increase in, you know, people's reported fears? And how are people, you know, how are these fears being propagated? So is this something we tend to, is this from a direct exposure or is it from learning, like watching other people or because our parents tell us to be afraid? So all of that interested me.
How did you study it and what were the results?
Yeah, well, we've done a few studies, actually. We have a couple of studies just ready to be submitted. But the first study we did that you referred to in 2012, we actually found some very interesting results. We found that about, and this was a large sample of undergraduate students, and off that large sample, we found that about half of them, a little less than half, had experienced a severe weather event, and that's not too surprising. What I think is kind of interesting with the, you know, 42% reported having experienced a severe weather event. And this is, you know, this would be a largely Atlantic Canadian group of students. And we don't have a whole lot of severe weather events like some other areas of North America. Like the Midwest. But my most recent, I'm seeing those numbers. We now have four studies, and each study shows a little bit increased percentage reportings exposure to severe weather. So I think that's intriguing and something I will watch. What we found was people were particularly afraid of the events that they'd experienced were hurricanes, thunder and lightning, blizzards. But the thing that they tend to fear, and I find this really intriguing, and it's not just in my study, but Westerfeld's and others as well, people fear tornadoes. So 62% of the participants in my study showed at least a moderate level of fear of tornadoes, even though only 16% had experienced tornadoes. So tornadoes tend to be something that captures the imagination.
And so is this in all regions, or is this specifically in regions that have tornadoes?
Well, no, that's the thing. It's not specific to regions. We get almost zero tornadoes in Nova Scotia, and people are still afraid of tornadoes. And we suspect the reason being is because of the media coverage. So thunder and lightning is much more common everywhere. And the number of deaths associated with thunder and lightning is almost as high as tornadoes, but we tend to fear tornadoes.
But it's okay. It could be media, and I appreciate that you are the expert here.
I'm not blaming you.
But could it also be like that this is something primal? I mean, I ask this in spite of being a person who has grown up in the Midwest where there are tornadoes. I will tell you, as a child, I had a weird recurring tornado dream that is not particularly grounded in reality. And I don't think I was old enough to be influenced by the media. You know what I mean?
No. And I think that's a great point. In fact, I'll tell you, we are prepared. You know, we do know that there's a preparedness in some people that we all have to be fearful of certain stimuli. And severe weather would make sense, right? If we think of it from an evolutionary standpoint, it would make sense that we be fearful of weather. So we have a biological preparedness, and some of us are more prepared to be fearful than others. People learn their fears of severe weather largely from direct exposure. Now, that doesn't perhaps mean that they have to be exposed to a tornado, but maybe extreme winds, some unpredictable weather event. And I think tornado, just as I say, captures people's imagination. It might sort of just get caught up in that. So the biggest learning experience is actually direct exposure, although there's probably some genetic component and some biological preparedness. And then we also have vicarious learning. And that is, we see others are afraid, or we have parents that tell us we should be afraid.
Or we read storybooks about other kids who are afraid.
Or we watch, as one of my students recently said to me, The Wizard of Oz. You know, maybe it's the Wizard of Oz phenomena that, you know, anybody who's familiar with the story maybe fears, maybe got exposed to fears of weather from that story. So there is
a tornado leads to flying monkeys.
Exactly.
Well, but I guess my other question for you is, you've said that tornadoes are the biggest fear. Is there, you know, there are lots of different things that happen during all kinds of storms and in the atmosphere. And I wonder if there's a specific thing that triggers the fear most, like would it be the changing color of the sky, or, you know what I'm asking?
Great question. Oh, that's a great question, because that's a question we actually included in our most recent study. So I'll be able to, I'll give you the preliminary results. We asked people what were the elements that scared them the most. Was it the sights, the sounds, the feel? And we provided them with the option of giving other examples. Sights and sounds were the biggies, but people also reported things like the sky changing color, the changing sky. seems to be a sensitivity to atmospheric pressure or barometric pressure, like changes in barometric pressure. The quietness before a storm tends to be unnerving for people. So there's a whole range of senses, sensory experiences that occur that really, we have so very little research in this area, we don't know any of this. This is all sort of just new that we're actually asking people, what are the triggers? You know, what are the things that alarm you the most?
Well, let's talk to someone who deals with astrophobia on a personal level. Christina Bradley is with us from Koshkonong, Missouri. And Christina, hello.
Hi, good morning.
You know, I just want to acknowledge, I understand this time of year is especially hard for you because of the events that triggered your astrophobia to begin with.
Correct. My dad was killed in Mayflower, Arkansas tornado. Tomorrow will be 4 years anniversary of that event.
I'm so sorry. I mean, I'm curious about before that happened. Were you afraid of severe weather and storms as a kid at all?
Not so much as a kid. I had a healthy respect for storms. However, my grandmother was very scared of storms. So we were in storm shelters every severe thunderstorm warning. We were in there.
Did you grow up in Missouri as well?
No, I grew up in Arkansas.
And so you would go
around the Little Rock area.
Yeah. And you would spend storms in shelters because your grandmother was afraid of them.
Yes. Yeah.
As your own fear developed, and it sounds like was triggered by, I mean, just it's the most natural thing in the world that to lose someone in severe weather would inspire a really strong fear of severe weather. But like at the height of it, what did you experience during a storm?
During that particular storm, I think what really triggered this is seeing the destruction and seeing the loss that weather event caused. 16 people lost their lives in that storm. And also I was around, we just moved from Moore, Oklahoma when the tornado had went through that area. And also, if you remember, Joplin, Missouri was hit. And we got some weather from that storm as well.
So following that event, what did you experience relating to storms? How did your fear show itself?
Like you said, I know that it's pretty understandable why I panic about it. I panic more than my other family members who were also, they also experienced they also experienced the damage. We reacted totally different. I get panicked. When the warnings start coming in days ahead of time, I stay at a heightened alertness over the weather.
What
for sure?
Heightened alertness. What is that like?
I keep very close watch on the weather. I'm very weather aware.
Do you like track it constant? Does it interfere with your life?
Not so much as it did. I feel like it's improving, but I don't know that it will ever go away. But yeah, you can on social media or just anywhere. In our area, they'll kind of let you know a few days ahead of time if you have severe weather headed your direction. And so when I hear things like that, I'm immediately trying to prepare my house and my family for you have to have a plan. It is scary because sometimes it is okay and sometimes it works out and everyone's safe, but like in my father's case, sometimes it doesn't work out that way. So you need to have a plan.
When you say you prepare your house, doing what kinds of things?
I prepare our safe room, with bottled water and blankets, and I'm just prepared to move everyone into that space.
Do you think go on.
Yeah. I'm usually the first one in there, just contemplating when it would be acceptable to make everyone else join me.
Do you think, I mean, do you think that not having 2 days of warning would actually be better for you?
I don't know how to answer that. I'm not sure if it would or not. I'm a person, I like to be armed with information. You know, you have to have the tools to know what you're up against.
You know, Missouri seems like it would be a tough place to be deeply affected by just the news of an impending storm, and particularly a tornado likely to hit. This might sound flip, but do you ever think about moving?
I really don't. And it's challenging to be in an area where storms are so prevalent. But I feel like every year since then, like I said, we're coming up on 4 years, and every storm season I feel gets a little better. And maybe you just have to, you have to feel it to heal it kind of thing with myself.
How do you think
each storm season that passes, that we're all still alive and safe, you know, we got through one more.
I'm guessing that there are probably people listening to this who have experienced a traumatic severe weather event and might really relate to what you're talking about. Do you think that it's just time that's made it better, or have specific things you've done helped you get better every year?
In my house, I'm really primarily the only one that's really, some people would call overboard with my reaction to storms because of what happened. And I'm not sure if it is time, or I write a lot about it in my own personal journals. It's not really an accepted thing in my family. It's just kind of pushed to the side, and kind of a get over it scenario. Everyone's safe, get over it. So I don't know what other people are doing. I'm not sure what would even be recommended by a professional. I didn't know that was an option, even, that there was help out there for stuff like that.
Yes.
Yeah, Margo, jump back in here. What do you hear in Christina's story?
Well, first off, my expression of condolence, Christina, on the loss of your father. And I guess. I have a couple of things to say. One is you have an extreme fear of, in this case, tornadoes or bad weather, but it so makes sense. You've had a traumatic event. So one of the things that somebody like me would be doing is assessing whether this is a storm phobia, is this a fear of storms, or is this a post-traumatic response? Because it often is the case that people who have direct exposure with a severe event, it's a traumatic event for them. So that's important to keep in mind, that you've been through a traumatic event with the loss of a loved one, and you know that's a very serious thing. So I just commend that you're able to sit here 4 years later and say, you know, it's getting better, because you've been through a traumatic event. We actually do have effective treatments, and that's what's kind of so sad about people don't seek out treatment and they don't know about it, because treatments are really quite effective. And in particular, cognitive behavioral therapy, which involves exposure. So three components. One is people get education about their fear and what is normal, you know, what would be a normal response, what's abnormal, education about the risks of different types of storm events. Then they also learn how to identify their particular ways of thinking that might be maintaining the fear. So people who are fearful, whether it's of storms or other things, tend to overestimate the likelihood and also tend to catastrophize how bad something's going to be.
What was the third thing?
And the third thing is exposure. So this is, we do a graduated exposure process whereby you introduce people, you expose them to the feared stimulus.
Yeah.
In a graduated way.
Yeah. Margo, thank you so much. And Christina Bradley of Koshkonong, Missouri, thank you.
Thank you.
Margo is the author of Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wind? Origins of the Severe Weather Phobia. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now we're going to get caught up on what is going on at the American Jazz Museum. It's been crazy for a little while, but the news is coming fast and furious ever since a report came out suggesting that the best way forward for the troubled institution would be to close temporarily and basically start all over on everything from exhibitions to staffing and financial structuring, really almost everything. KCUR's Laura Spencer is here to help us understand it. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Gina.
So Chepto Kosatani Buckner has just announced her plans to step down as executive director. That's obviously the latest, but let's start at the beginning-ish with the report I just mentioned. The city hired some outside consultants to evaluate the Jazz Museum. What inspired that?
Well, the Jazz Museum had a number of challenges last year, including financial difficulties, and so a bunch of different ideas were tossed around. But city council members asked the city manager to have an evaluation done of the museum, and that was last in October, and then it was just released to the public in early April.
Financial troubles to the tune of?
Well, the Jazz Museum had an ambitious jazz festival last May over Memorial Weekend, and there was a $400,000 deficit from that. And then it's more information has come out about a little bit over a million dollar deficit.
So what did this report say?
Well, the report had 26 recommendations, including 5 that they considered sort of immediate, needing immediate action. And one of those was a recommendation to close the museum temporarily up to a year to help save money and to really take a hard look at the collection and the exhibits, and also a refresh, as they put it, of staff and board. And that's what led to the decision yesterday, or the announcement by Chepto Kosatani Buckner, of deciding to step down.
You know, when I read the highlights of this report, I guess you could call them, or maybe lowlights, in the story that you wrote about it, my jaw seriously dropped, because the part about the stale exhibits, you hear about the very, like, operational difficulties in the news, but the idea that they're also kind of saying that the content needed work, that, you know, once you're there, you might not be even having such a great experience.
And I would say that KCUR had a study that we did of listener surveys a couple years ago, and that was a common refrain. You go to the American Jazz Museum, you see it, and there's, according to some folks we talked to, they didn't see a reason to go back. And so I think some of the information that came out in the report, although it seemed scathing, was also maybe not surprising to people.
So how have stakeholders responded to this really incredibly damning report?
Well, the board members of the American Jazz Museum mentioned that the report followed a recent survey that they had done. So some of this information are things that they felt like they were working on and working towards, but not necessarily having the funds to complete everything. I think, frankly, I don't think people have been surprised by this report. I think what has been surprising is the recommendation to close the museum for up to a year.
And then, obviously, like this latest news that you've been covering, that Chepto Kosatani Buckner is stepping down. When she was hired, there was so much hope that she was going to take things in a new direction.
Yeah, she had a great reputation in the Kansas City Public Library. She'd been there for 25 years and had, you know, worked on a number of collaborations. And so I think there were really high hopes that she would continue those cultural collaborations and kind of boost the profile of the museum.
The other news then, of course, is that most of the board plans to step down as well.
The annual board of directors meeting will take place on May 15th, and one of the recommendations in the report was kind of winnowing down the board members to 8 to 10, and so Anita Maltbia suggested only having 3 members stay, and I guess that's part of the Missouri law, having three members stay so they can kind of help usher in the new board of directors.
One of the big, I guess, scandals since Chepto came on board was with that jazz festival you mentioned last summer at Memorial Day weekend. It was really ambitious, and it ended up not making enough money from ticket sales. Musicians went unpaid for a long time.
That's right. And we actually ended up hearing a little bit about that on Facebook. Musicians were frustrated by getting bounced checks and not being paid. And so we started following up on that reporting. And it turned out about 10 musicians had not been paid because of bounced checks. And so that's kind of when more information came out about some of the financial difficulties from the festival and then ongoing financial challenges.
What are your big questions going forward?
I feel like I have a lot of questions. There was a lot of public testimony yesterday at the Finance and Governance Committee, and I feel like there are kind of a lot of threads to kind of tease out about how cultural institutions are funded in the city, as well as kind of what's going forward. I feel like from testimony yesterday, there's a lot of optimism, but I think people really are hopeful that there will be change.
Laura Spencer, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Laura Spencer is KCUR's arts reporter. Let's hear now from Quentin Lucas. He's a city councilman representing the 3rd District at large. Hi, Quentin.
Hi, Gina.
So forgetting politics, if we can, for just one second, how do you personally feel about what's going on at the Jazz Museum?
You know, to Laura's last point, I feel optimism about where we're headed, but certainly disappointment with where we've been, not just over the last year, but I think a common conversation and refrain is that the American Jazz Museum isn't quite performing where it needs to be. And so I think we really want to see it go further to be this real jewel of the community that we can be proud of.
When you say you're optimistic, I don't mean to like be the dark rain cloud forming over your head or anything, but where are you deriving optimism?
You know, I think what we saw from this process is that there are a lot of people that care about the American Jazz Museum. Last night, I was at a different event, and folks said, what can we do to help? So that's where at least there is some optimism. And I think what we can see coming out of this board report is that there is some sort of stimulus for a path forward. And that's what we need more than anything. Instead of kind of just brushing over what are longstanding concerns and complaints, we're really trying to do something here, and I think that's positive.
What insights do you have on what has kind of gone wrong as someone who's met with the people most intimately involved, someone who knows the intricacies of the politics around it all, someone who's part of the community? You live near the American Jazz Museum.
A few different things. I think first of all is that we needed to have slightly better governance and oversight. I think it's a smart recommendation that we look to what is our board? Why is it that the board isn't really in the fundraising business, which every nonprofit board I know tends to do? And then I think there's another important part, which is that we have a number of different masters for the Jazz Museum. Who do you answer to? Is it the city council? Is it the city manager? Is it the board of directors? Is it external actors? Is it the community? And so what I hope this process gives is the museum an opportunity to say, what is it that we're doing? What is our importance in the community? And how do we do it best? And I include in that not just the collections, which have some challenges, but also long-term programming so that we get the story of jazz and music and the African-American community shared, not just in Kansas City, but more broadly.
So what is the direction forward as far as you're concerned?
You know, as far as I'm concerned, I heard the news about Chepto Kosatani Buckner stepping down. It looks like we'll at least have an interim director for some time, and we'll have to find new board members that hopefully address some of the concerns we had, which is folks that are into fundraising, who know operations, who know music. And I think one other thing I'd like to see, I'm a member of the board, my colleague in the 3rd District is, perhaps it's time to get some of the politicians out of that level of control.
Yourself included?
Myself included, right? I'm trained to do a few things. Running museums isn't one of them. And so I think what might be best is if we let some professionals come in, folks with museum experience, folks with music experience, and really try to look at a path forward, a business path forward for this museum.
What does a museum like this mean to Kansas City in your view?
You know, I think it should mean a lot. Should mean a lot more than it has. You know, I was telling Laura actually before we came on, I had my high school prom at this museum years ago, right? And the Jazz Museum was kind of this brand new thing, and it was an exciting thing to go to 18th and Vine. And I want not only more people to be able to have experiences like that, but for it to be something that people talk about in their set of, when you come to Kansas City, this is something that you see. When you hear about what's going on, we think about activities at 18th and Vine and at the Jazz Museum and at the Gym Theater. And so I think what we're looking for is for it to have this impact beyond just it existing and it being a place with artifacts, but instead it being something that's living and spreading, I think, a cultural message.
Is a museum like this, a museum to jazz, enough to preserve jazz in Kansas City? Or is there another piece of it that we might also be kind of ignoring here when we put too many of our hopes in a space like that?
You know, I don't think it's too much. In the same way that art museums and libraries, which fundamentally have things that have been produced already, are exciting and are drawing people, I think we can have that same opportunity here. So what I see this as is an opportunity for real music and cultural sharing.
You can join this conversation about the future of the American Jazz Museum and how to best honor our local jazz legacy at 816-235-2888. We'll bring musicians in on the conversation, too. I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about celebrating and preserving Kansas City's jazz legacy in light of all the difficulties they're having at the American Jazz Museum. We've been chatting with City Councilman Quentin Lucas, representing the 3rd District at large, and now I want to bring musicians in on this discussion because it seems like they would probably have something to say. Let's start with Logan Richardson. He's joining us from Rome. He is a big deal in the jazz world, and he doesn't live here, but Logan, you're from here originally, right?
Absolutely. Hi, thank you for having me and anything I can offer in this conversation. I just want to say that first. Thank you. And yes, I was born and raised in the inner city of Kansas City, born in 1980. I'm born and bred and from that land. Yes.
Does being from Kansas City mean something in the jazz world today?
Absolutely. It's interesting for me even that's even a question as to the way that just not only music history or jazz history or whatever exists, but in terms of just American and world history. It's an absolute that somehow being from Kansas City and the elements and influence that's come from Kansas City seems to hold more weight around the world than it does in Kansas City itself in terms of the way the legacy is upheld.
Yeah, you mentioned that. I mean, you came home last summer for the big jazz festival that we've mentioned that was put on by the American Jazz Museum, and you kind of challenged the crowd to think about that and also to think about whether and how kids living in the neighborhood around 18th and Vine were being invited in on the party, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first thing I'll say is that it's interesting for me speaking about this now at this point. Because, you know, my history, at least with that particular place, is that I initially started going down there and hanging out because there was a institute that was put on by the museum, but it was from the city, but it was pre the museum. So it was when it was still Parade Park, when that community center was still up on 18th Street. I used to play baseball in that field. I remember in the field where it used to not exist. And we used to be across the street in the Lincoln building, in the historic building. And the first year of this institute, which would have been 1996, I believe, we had a little blueprint of what the American Jazz Museum was supposed to be. And we're looking out the window across the street and just looking at this open field and saying, oh, wow, that's going to be awesome. And so I'm in on this level. I remember everything before it. I remember playing on that land before it was ever there. And my first actual official job, because I was playing gigs ever since I was about 16. So when I was about 18, I took a year off after high school and I worked in the swing shop down in the gift shop there. So I'm really in the admissions desk. So, I mean, I'm well versed in terms of my particular emotional and intellectual relationship with this institution, coming from the initial director to the initial curators to the following director to everyone else down the line.
So, I mean, what do you think about what's happening now? Does it come as a surprise to you?
Well, I mean, the thing is that for me in particular, it's absolutely not a surprise. In fact, most of these things, I'm just glad that this particular conversation is finally happening. This has been going on for the last two directors that have been there. The previous director, Greg Carroll, that was another debacle in terms of the way things were ran, the amount of money that wasn't raised, the amount of funds that were going out, and nothing was coming back. Nobody was curating anything. They didn't even really know what they had in the basement or what they did have. They haven't changed any of the exhibits of who knows how many years. The upkeep, the presentation, but yet fundraisers would happen, and then this money would just go wherever it would go. And so, I mean, this has been going on. I mean, I've seen. I think CJ Janvoy. I believe
yeah,
that's
CJ Janvoy.
Last name. She. Yeah, Genevieve. Sorry, I know I was going to pronounce it. No, I'm sorry, CJ. In any case, I saw one extensive report that she had did, and it was just like she opened up my eyes so much that I didn't even know. I mean, this has been going on forever. So the thing is even, you know, I hear what the councilman's saying and everything like this, but at the same time, if someone's been on the board of this particular institution and they are claiming that they were not aware that this is nothing new, this is absolutely nothing new. So whatever, I'm not creating any type of beef on any level except being direct about that particular information. And anyone that claims that they didn't know that this is going on and all this kind of strangeness surrounding funds not coming in any type of donated funds in the sums of millions, half a millions of dollars, just somehow, you know, dissipating just into thin air and no one knows what happens and yeah, in any other situation, no one would believe that, and I certainly do not. And those that I know, I have my people, I know different. So,
in a perfect world, I mean, what does a jazz museum in Kansas City look like and do?
Well, the thing is, first off, your actual exhibit certainly is not the smallest circumference inside of the entire building. The changing gallery, in fact, is probably bigger than the actual permanent exhibit. There's something wrong with this. I think the Weebop room, maybe even almost the same circumference, which is the room where they have little programs for children inside of the Jazz Museum. So meaning just the actual, you know, I don't know. I spend my life now traveling the world, and I get an opportunity to be able to see so many great things and places that I wouldn't get to see. So I'm always checking out structures and the appeal and the way that a place can make you feel before you've ever actually even reached the artifacts or the actual thing that you went to seek. And the way that it's designed, the lighting, there's no natural light. Everything's dark. It needs to be restructured. And that's okay, because, you know, like anything that you build, your first incarnation isn't necessarily what it was always meant to stay as forever. It's a museum is something that is living. It has things that have shown why we live now, and that's the whole important thing. If we're not showing that we're living now via the way that the interior design and the exterior design kind of present itself, the way that you allow the artifacts to be able to live and breathe and you treat them with that respect. Any museum that actually does that, that's why we love them so much. It's not only the artifacts are so amazing, they created the environment to allow the artifact to live in a peaceful habitat, and that's important to respect that.
Okay.
And so there needs to be a complete reevaluation in terms of the way that physical venue is presented.
Well, Logan Richardson, hang on with me. I want to bring another musician in on this. We're going to talk to Herman Mahari. He does live here. At least he's pretty much based here, though he spends a lot of his time in Paris and on tour. Herman's a jazz musician, but he's also known for collaborating in the hip hop scene, doing a lot of different things. And he's with us from Paris now. Hi, Herman.
Hi, how's it going?
Pretty good. I want to ask you this same question. In a perfect world, what does a jazz museum in Kansas City look like and do?
Well, you know, for me, it's a museum, and it's more than that. You know, it should be like it's an institution. And so I look at some great examples around the country, like Lincoln Center in New York and SF Jazz in San Francisco, and then Jazz St. Louis, you know, even closer to home.
What's different about those places?
Well, they're all growing every year. They keep raising more and more money. They have all built specific venues specifically just for the presentation of this music. And they have amazing programming, and they have a huge subscriber base. And like, if you can look at the Lincoln Center's mission, it's just like a museum. Their mission is just like a museum. So their educational outreach programs are fantastic. I mean, it's really what we should have in Kansas City.
What about this bigger question of how we get beyond lip service in supporting the music and spirit of jazz along with its history?
Well, you know, it's complicated. I mean, I think a lot of it is about finding this balance of dealing with what's going on now and having people, you know, involved that know what's happening with the music. And at the same time, being involved with what the city has offered in the past, you know, in terms of the music is what's concerned.
When you think about what Logan said earlier about just the idea that, like, that the American Jazz Museum, that people in other parts of the world put more value on the fact that he's from Kansas City than maybe people in Kansas City do, for example, just that maybe other parts of the world appreciate that part of our history more than we sometimes do.
Yeah, that's very true. It's everywhere I go, you know, people, it's the same thing. But you know, I think like part of like even the missions of these other places I mentioned, SF Jazz or whatever, you know, part of their mission is to get the people in their localities to support the music better. Like part of Jazz St. Louis's mission is to get greater recognition for jazz in St. Louis. And that's a mission that the American Jazz Museum could also have as well.
When people talk about you, a lot of what they talk about is that in addition to being a great jazz musician, that you also bring other genres into the work you do, and that you're kind of, for a lot of people, this sort of dream of a future of jazz because your music appeals to more than the traditional jazz audience. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure, that's ultra kind, first of all, but I mean, I think the same thing of Logan's music. To me, I mean, it's just a matter of involving all the musics I listen to. You know, I love jazz, but I love all kinds of music too. And in fact, I listen to other music more than I do jazz, especially nowadays. And even growing up though, I didn't listen to jazz when I was really young. So to me, it's just a natural extension of what I'm doing on a personal level. And
So how do you reach those young kids though, who are like, you hadn't heard jazz when you were young? How do you reach that audience and make sure that, because that's what it takes to make sure that jazz survives, right? Is to reach that audience.
I think you got to get them excited about live music. You know, like the perfect example of this continuing now to this day is in New Orleans. You know, you have kids playing in brass bands, you know, like from the neighborhood. These kids are young and excited about, there's a whole culture about live music, and you have black kids playing trumpet and trombone and it's like we need these programs for our people in Kansas City too, in the inner cities.
Logan Richardson, jump back in here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the biggest component more than anything is awareness, and I say that to say that if those that know are aware, and then those that don't know are at least aware that they don't know, then I think that creates a particular ground for all of us to grow. So meaning like when we speak about how to bring more attention to or more respect for this particular institution, bringing it back to like the 18th and Vine and Museum and whatnot, this would seem that then we would have to pay attention to the actual missionaries that are going out and spreading the word about Kansas City and its tradition and whatnot via what they do. And I would imagine that would be Herman and myself, for example, but there are many other people.
Oh, we're kind of losing our... I think you just mentioned Crystal Warren.
Oh, Crystal Warren, yes. Who she lives in Paris as well, Solomon Dorsey. I mean, there are many great artists that are out here originally from Kansas City, but there's always been and that represent the city everywhere we go. When people ask us, that's where we're from, and they say, oh, wow, Kansas City. But yet, when you come back to Kansas City, sometimes it's not exactly, I don't receive in that way. So I think we definitely need to find a way to be able to get back to the students and mothers and fathers and whatnot of the community to be able to create the next level of creativity and interest in this historic legacy that is living now.
Well, so
is living.
Logan and Herman, I know it's nighttime for both of you right now. Have a good evening.
Yeah. Do the same. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Quentin Lucas, I know we're on our way out. I'm guessing that you are taking some notes here.
I agree with everything that was said. Look forward to a positive museum in the future.
Well, our time is up. City Councilman Quentin Lucas, it's been so helpful hearing your perspective. Thanks for stopping by. And that is a wrap. We spoke with KCUR's Laura Spencer earlier in this conversation. Keep talking to us on Twitter about your ideas for how to move forward as a jazz city. We're at KCUR CST. Tomorrow, French food, Kansas City style, and a chat with the Costco employee with serious French pastry making skills. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.